So, welcome to our second Sipple IP talk. Thanks a lot for dropping in. So we're really pleased and have the honor of hosting Cathy Bowrey, a professor at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia, who has been here at Sipple for, I'd say, 3 weeks, roughly?
Three weeks, yeah.
But has to go back to Australia, to probably warm and sunny Australia, this weekend, hot and unpleasant. It's going to be better than this in terms of climate, in any case. So we're really happy to have you here, and we're going to talk about essentially the history of merchandising and the role of intellectual property. So I'll leave it at that. Yep. Thank you, Cathy, and the floor is yours.
Okay. Well, thanks for the opportunity to speak to you tonight, and thanks particularly to Lionel and to Henning for hosting me at Sipple. So what I'm going to talk about today is some work that I'm doing with Dr. Jose Bolido from Kent University, which is really a book about the commodification of childhood, intellectual property, and the toy industry. But what we're hoping to do through that window is engage a much larger IP discourse about the making of intellectual property rights in the 20th century. What I'm going to present today is a highly abbreviated version of the first three chapters. What I'm going to do is actually explain some of the methodology and conclusion, really, of the first three chapters of this book. And the research revolves around two general themes. The first one, how do creators and innovators make sense of their commercial and their legal opportunities? It's something we don't spend a lot of time thinking about in law, and I think it is actually a really, really important question to think about. How do they actually understand the law? How do they actually use it? What type of expectations do they actually have? Secondly, what would a legal history of commodification look like? Now, what do I mean by that? I reckon in terms of contemporary intellectual property subject matter, and particularly toys, in terms of their production, in terms of their distribution, in terms of how goods are experienced, there's a world of difference between the rights that might attach to, let's call it a utilitarian toothbrush, and a toothbrush with a Disney character on it. They are created under entirely different conditions. They circulate legally. There's a whole range of very different types of transactions. They're not, in other words, there might be two toothbrushes, but they're not really doing the same type of job, and the legal relations and their problems of circulation of these different types of commodities is highly, highly differentiated. And so that's the type of distinction that my work's trying to draw out. What is that, and how does that distinction come into being? Another way of looking at it more loosely is that how does culture, economy and law interact? So the conventional story of intellectual property and character merchandising starts with this type of, I would argue, stylized cycle. The presumption is that creativity begins with the author, the work's brought to the public through mass reproduction. So that, to do that, the author enlists the work of the publisher and the printer, who uses industrial plant and technology to multiply their work. And in order to do that, there will be an assignment of any copyright. Commercialization is seen as the process by which those copies are mass reproduced and supplied to the retail trade, again protected by exclusive rights. And ultimately, through that cycle, goods find their way to the public, who can purchase them. There's a presumption that from a manufacturing perspective, there might be patents, there might be other types of intellectual property rights that come into the picture along that path. There might be other manufacturers who get involved. Advertising copy, other marketing strategies come to play, so trademarks might become relevant. But the presumption that there is some kind of logic where law is powering this virtuous cycle by protecting the intellectual property rights as they come into play in turn. Law imagines this as a very orderly and a very controlled terrain. Most of my work is actually trying to explain why that is simply not the case. That owning, asserting rights is not necessarily essential to this type of dynamic. That scale is often assumed as something we start small and just gets upscaled, and that's how things are successful. That's also something that I would like to problematize. So what I'm interested in is where did this legal imaginary of how intellectual property rights work in the economy really come from, and specifically with respect to character merchandising? Okay. So the myths that I'm going to address will start off with Beatrix Potter, with Alice in Wonderland, Beatrix, then Beatrix Potter, then we'll talk about Felix the Cat and Mickey Mouse. Now, does everyone know who these characters are? The reason I ask is that I went to another UK law school and people didn't know who Beatrix Potter was and didn't know who Peter Rabbit was, which I found astonishing. And it was a British university. So, anyway. Okay. So, one of the things I want to point out is why I believe that from a legal and business perspective, the type of character merchandising that Lewis Carroll and Beatrix Potter engaged in the late Victorian and the early Edwardian period is really entirely of a different nature to that which happens at the bottom of the screen with Felix the Cat and with Mickey Mouse in the 30s. And the key to understanding that is the key to understanding how commodification is very different in those eras. So I'm going to move on now to start talking very briefly about Lewis Carroll, The Nondeplume of Charles Dodson. Okay, so Lewis Carroll was clearly a very significant British author, but he's not usually credited as being a significant business or legal subject. He's considered to be a creative personality. He's engaged in reproducing his works through and dealing with publishers, but partly because I think we come to understand who Lewis Carroll is through the work of literary historians, he kind of comes prepackaged. His legal subjectivity is already inscribed by author theories and personality readings that are used to explain his business relations. So Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, first published in 1865. There were 11,000 copies printed between 1865 and 1870, so it was immediately very successful. He was deeply involved in the design and the production of this work for his friends and to the public. And his interest wasn't actually simply in the actual words or the text. As you can see from this slide here, the mouse tail, he was really interested in the graphic representation of his work. He was interested in it, if you like, in an interactive sense. He wanted children and the parents to actually engage with his fictional universe, not as a story that was passively read to, but something that they actually immersed them into his fantasy world. He negotiated with publishers, with illustrators, with composers, with actors, with designers, with manufacturers and retailers, all with a view to actually trying to curate how the Alice fictional universe was experienced. So John Tenniel's illustrations were taken to appeal to both young and old. And there's even a debate about whether or not what he wrote was a children's book. One of the arguments for Virginia Woolf in 1929 argued that these are books not for children, but they're books in which we all become children. And so there's an interesting thing about how he actually understands the public as his audience, but also how he understands the public in a very particular way of actually encouraging them to actually reimagine their relationship with the world. But in terms of the type of decisions he made, yes, he was an author, but he selected the paper, the colour of the text, the material, the typewriting. He did weird things like in the, you know, thousands and thousands of copy, he was still going through checking the size of the margins, checking the quality of the typeproofing, a really, really high level of concern about his work, how his work was presented. And the early exploitation of Alice was very cautious and considered in terms of how he thought the work should connect with his child audiences. Part of the reason that these relationships and their significance from an IP perspective have been, I think, neglected is because it was an age of pay for publication. So right up until about, you know, 1890, a very, very high volume of literature, and particularly fantasy works, novels, poetry, it was always pay for publication. That basically the author Macmillan has a 10% commission, and their part of the arrangement is to actually engage with the manufacturing, retailing, marketing end. But the author also paid for the advertising as well. So because of that, it's all happening through contract. So the presumption is that this has got nothing to do with intellectual property rights. These are just contractual arrangements coming out of the fact that he's financing it. And that's certainly the case. I mean, if he's paying for it, he should be able to choose the paper. He should be able to choose how it looks. But he also, after experiencing what could be called publishing mishaps, publishing that he thought was of inferior quality and various mistakes. Those types of works were usually sold to America or the Australia to the colonies. But he actually had an explicit clause written, and I'll just read it. It's understood that the author has the control. No details will be carried out without his actual or implied consent. Okay, so I mean, one thing we might think about as intellectual property lawyers today is whether or not he's just strongly asserting his moral rights, making sure the integrity of the work through contract is secured in the absence of there being any common law or statutory right to do so. But he also did other weird things, well, things that I think of. He collected piracies, Alice imitations. Some of these annoyed him, but not all of them seemed to annoy him. He would participate in dramatic and musical renderings of Alice, even when they were pirated productions. He registered dramatic rights, but he pirated them. So he was, seems to me that his primary motivation is to be very concerned about keeping tabs and tracking the reception of his work. And all of the control that he did exercise was basically a very patriarchal control about wanting to actually make sure that the experience was as he had intended. Okay. He discriminated between the works that he wrote for children that he knew and the works that released into the marketplace. So this is the actually from the, it's in the, you can look at, see it on the British Library, it's reproduced digitally online. But that's the story that was written for Alice Liddell, Alice's Adventure Underground, which was the precursor to Alice in Wonderland. That's the last pages of it where he actually has the picture of Alice. He hand-drew it. He was also a photographer, which I'm sure you know, and he originally thought that the photographic rendering was better, so he pasted it over. What was interesting is that he understood there was different types of markets, and so there was a high-end publication of this as a facsimile edition later on, in 1886. But then the question is, what do you do about the personalisation of the text? One of the curious decisions that he made with that mass-reproduced, personalised edition was that he had to remove the picture of Alice and he wrote the end over it. And there's various theories about why he did that. Is it because he's reluctant about engaging in these types of commercial relations? Or is it because children now associate Alice with Tennille's drawings and therefore are going to be disturbed by another little girl's face being there because their whole fantasy of Alice is based on a very particular rendering? Okay. Because of his high level of control, one of the presumptions is that he's not really engaged in character merchandising, he's not really engaged fully in the commercial relations. But I'm going to talk about two examples of works that he did, which I think show quite a significant shift in thinking about commodification. This is a book with what was called Movable Effects. It was basically one of the things where you pull the slide and you get a different picture. These have been popular since about the 1850s, produced by a company called Dean & Sons, or the Dissolving Views. They are early forms of animation. With this, it actually says, and I'll quote, "This product contains pictorial surprises. You see Alice nursing the Duchess' baby, brackets, an entirely new combination, by the way, it doesn't occur in the book, close brackets. Now, with your right thumb and forefinger, lay hold of the little book and suddenly pull it out and the baby's turned into a pig." Okay. So the Carolians, literary historians, tend to see this product as simply an extension of his interest in puzzles and mathematical games, demonstrating his interest in communication rules. But if you think about what kind of product is it, this is a book which has sections on stamp cases, how to begin a letter, how to go on in a letter, how to end a letter, on registering correspondence. And at the end of the book, there's a long list of Alice Carroll publications at the end and the price and their available prices. Unlike a lot of the other things that he participated in, like magic lantern slides, the booklet here doesn't actually refer to the Alice narrative in any way at all. It's completely disconnected from the fictional universe. Or another way of putting it, it is the fictional universe is only present in this work in a very nebulous and abstract sense. So, in other words, Alice here is being treated more as a branding device. She's not actually there in order to extend the actual fantasy. And then there's this quote that appears. Some American writer says the snakes in the district may be divided into one species, the venomous. The same principle applies here. Postage stamp cases may be divided into one species, the Wonderland. Imitations of it will appear, no doubt, but they cannot include the two pictorial surprises, which are copyright. Okay, so in this instance, I would argue that Dodson's not only selling a booklet about letter writing etiquette, which is also an Alice branded commodity. In the process, what he's also trying to do is teach children about protocols of consumption. He understands that the image of the Duchess baby and the disappearing Cheshire cat are valuable commercial assets, and he's reminding his audience, children, that these animations are artistic works in which he owns the copyright, and he playfully is referencing the coercive role of the state as a poisonous snake who will strike out to protect his exclusive interests. Okay, so I think that this is actually quite an interesting and significant development in understanding him. The second example uses Tennille's drawings. It was a work of high technology for its time. It's a metal box maker was looking to publicise what was a new patented lithographic technique for tin plate printing. And the significance of this technology was you could transfer complex images onto rubber onto the surface rather than have to directly print onto the tin. So it meant that you could have much finer, high quality resolutions, brighter colours and the like. Now, the front surface of the lid of the biscuit tin carries the inscription by the kind permission of the author Lewis Carroll. Again, there's this protocol being introduced into the marketing of the good. The tin, however, also carried branding for Jacob's Biscuits, including an Alice theme advertisement on the underside of the lid. And he objected to that. He said it was not his intention to, quote, to vulgarise the boxes by turning them into advertising mediums. After much correspondence, he was placated by being given a quantity of tins that he insisted could be sent out empty to his friends. Okay. Now, I think that's really interesting as well, because it's a biscuit tin. He's removing the biscuits and sending it out as an art object, and it seems to me that he's really trying to erase his engagement in commodity relations by the act of removing the biscuits. It also seems to me that he was interested in engaging in commodity relations where they were perceived as circulating within artistic communities. But once it actually extends beyond that, that seems to me to be a step too far. So things, a ubiquitous product like, you know, packet biscuits was something that he thought was not suitable to be engaged with in the world of art in the same way. He was much more ambivalent about it. Okay. The distinction between him and Beatrix Potter is, of course, that she had none of those reservations about engaging in commerce. There's some similarities in the stories between the creation of Alice and Beatrix Potter. Potter's Tale of Peter Rabbits was also based on a letter written to a sick child, five-year-old Normore, that she wrote in 1893. But she consciously designed the book because it would be comfortable for small hands to hold. She was very involved, like Dodson, in making sure that there were high quality colour reproductions, and she paid a lot extra for that. She self-published with a firm called Strange Ways and Sums. She originally couldn't find a publisher, and that ends up becoming a problem in copyright terms, which I'll talk about in a minute. Warne and Sons became interested in reprinting the tale, but because they weren't the first publisher, they couldn't honestly comply with the technical copyright restrictions for registration, where you had to actually nominate that registration could be made by the first publisher. So we've looked high and low. There doesn't appear to be any Beatrix Potter registration for the Tale of Peter Rabbit in the UK. Warne offered her a deferred royalty arrangement based on a standard publisher association's agreement. She contributed to the cost of the printing by foregoing royalties on the first 3,000 copies and thereafter got a 10% royalty on the retail price. But as you can see by this image, she also engaged in her own fantasy by creating this Peter Rabbit doll. She made the prototype in 1903 and registered her design right. Why did she think of this? Though her father trained as a barrister, it appears he didn't spend much time in practice, but he lived off family money, which was generated from the Manchester textile printing trade. Copyright registration of textiles design was very well established in the 18th century, and I'm assuming that her family connection to the trade meant that she did actually grow up around an awareness of this technical area of law and the importance of design law to manufacturing. But whereas Lewis Carroll was interested in tracing the engagement of audiences with his work, she was a shopper. She was much more interested in questions of production and the circulation of goods at large. So in her personal letters, Beatrix Potter mentions things like going to Hamley's toy store, looking at the first British department store, Whiteley's. She goes to Harrods. She goes to visit J.K. Farnell, British stuffed toy maker. She especially mentions a German origin velveteen policeman doll, which was on sale at Harrods as the inspiration for the Peter Abbott doll design. And she wrote to her publisher, Harrods said they were bringing a doll out like the advert of Sunny Jim. There's a run on toys copied from pictures. Okay, so this is really interesting. Beatrix Potter wasn't just interested in designing and creating ways and people could engage in her fantasy of the Peter Rabbit world. She's actually reading popular culture trends and feeding into that in a very active way. It's the idea of what's actually going on in the marketplace with Beatrix Potter is feeding her ideas about what it is possible to do with the Peter Rabbit universe. So as you can see, this is Sunny Jim. Sunny Jim was a fictional character created in the US as part of an advertising campaign for Force breakfast cereal. Jim Dumps becomes Sunny Jim after he eats Force breakfast cereal. And it really took off. It was one of those fluke kind of advertising campaigns that catch on. So people started actually making up stories about Sunny Jim. So there were stories about Sunny Jim's family, cook, the janitor, the girl upstairs. People made their own jingles, not just the advertising versions, but there were popular jingles. Popular culture, in other words, was starting to impact on the manufacturing of product and creating an interest in designs. At the turn of the century, there was also a gollywog craze, and from 1902, the teddy bears become fashionable. Teddy bears weren't previously so cute and cuddly. They were much more realistic. But after the American president, Theodore Roosevelt, took pity on a bear in a hunting trip, they got rebadged as teddy bears and became much cuter. They were launched at the Leipzig Toy Fair in 1903. Okay. She also made a board game almost a decade earlier than the actual date here, 1917. She originally made it and she played it with Friedrich Wann's kids to actually, in a sense, test out whether the children found the game amusing and attractive. Okay, so what's the point about Lore here? She's clearly much more involved in the making of product and consumer practices than Lewis Carroll was. But there are also similar practices of authorial control being expressed through the personal relations with those who make the goods. She wanted to understand how they were experienced. She wanted extended opportunities for play. She also, when she assigned her rights originally to Friedrich Wann Publishing in 1902, she insisted on the right to be able to repurchase her work at a later stage. So she's aware that this might have longevity and she might want to maintain control. There's a significant difference in scale and product diversification between Lewis Carroll and Beatrix Potter. She licensed what she later called many sideshows, which were adaptations of design on artwork, wallpaper, games, wrappers, greeting cards, Christmas cards, wall pictures, pocketbooks, almanacs, jigsaw puzzles, chinas, statuettes. So there's an enormous array of merchandise which is wearing Peter Rabbit and her other characters. One of the things that is interesting with Beatrix Potter is that her original authorship and what I would call industrial authorship is starting to fold in on itself, because she's not designing all these products. Some of them she comments on, some of them she likes, some of them she thinks she doesn't particularly like. So what ends up happening with Beatrix Potter's merchandising is all these discrete products have different origins, different makers, but that difference is masked by a common visual identity and an attribution of Beatrix Potter as the author of those works, even when in fact she's not the author of the work in terms of the sense of the person who's actually provided the labour. Her brand name, if you like, is applied regardless of the pragmatics of the object's actual manufacturing. She's sometimes included in the concept of piracies, works that were made by German labour but weren't subject to the same restriction on working hours and fair wages as, she said, had been achieved by the Factories Act. And she says, quote, "We're fighting with one hand tied so long as there is no import duty. The London toy shops are choked with foreign toys." In the first decade of the 20th century, toy traders complained that there was no import tax on toys, which made it very difficult for them to compete with German toys. The big toy fairs were also of German origin, so it became a natural point for British toy makers to simply come over, go over to the German toy fairs, and then license the goods into, or purchase and import the goods into the British market. So as the free trade debate heated up in 1910, she became involved in it. So this poster of the Camberwell doll comes from that era. There was another poster that she designed, which was a picture of a Peter Rabbit doll, which has Peter Rabbit has a price tag attached, and the banner says "Made in Germany." And it was accompanied by a little note that said, "German ships are being built on the profits of the German trade with England." But she did balk at Harold Warne's suggestion that they should have a booklet called "Peter Rabbit on Politics." She said it would savour of advertisement, and don't you see, it'll do that thing you dislike, drag that little book into radical politics. Okay, so in terms of summing up Beatrix Potter, in her own terms, the commercialisation story does begin with an original author. There's other players involved in the commercialisation, but it is reasonably controlled through the various IP licences that she puts in place. What I would call the legal imaginary of character merchandising is really the Beatrix Potter story. But what I'm going to argue now is it doesn't necessarily fit with what I consider to be the primary form of character merchandising that takes place in the 20th century. But there's other things that make also Beatrix Potter an anomaly. She lost copyright on the tale of Peter Rabbit in the US because she failed to comply with US copyright technicalities. So in 1891, the Chase Act came into being, and the US recognises foreign copyrights, but it's subject to quite a lot of technicalities. There had to be a registration of the title with the Library of Congress on or before the date of publication. Deposit of copies was required on or before the date of publication, and there was really no grace period allowed for in the 1891 statute, and although in practice some late deposit was allowed. But the books also had to be printed and typeset in the US. And a US copyright notice had to be included on all copies. So in other words, to affect international trade, US copyright required investment in an international business infrastructure in order to facilitate the meaning of those rights. Frederick Warne was aware of this and had set up an agency in the US, but this was probably their first copyright registration and they failed to do it properly. I think there was also the problem, which they would have been aware of, that they weren't first publisher, it had already been published by Strangeway and Sons, so there's a whole range of other problems there. But it meant that not only was she annoyed about that, it became a terrible problem in terms of preventing the importation of US origin piracies into Britain, because the book was protected in Britain, but public domain in the States. And there's lots of stuff with her arguing with customs officials, and Penguin eventually also arguing with customs officials about how to actually prevent these piracies coming into the English market. But with Beatrix Potter, it also meant that she always associated intellectual property rights with manufacturing and manufacturing politics. And I think that comes from her family background, but also because of her experience with the American piracies. That is also something that I think is a more of a pre-modern understanding of copyright and design rights than what takes place in the 20th century, which I would call a modern form of those rights. Originally, the first Copyrights Act in the UK and the first Designs Act also were there to sponsor British manufacturing and to raise the quality of British trade. It was a traditional justification for those rights. So again, she has more in common, I think, with those much earlier legislations than what actually happens with this character. Okay. So Felix's origins, Felix the Cat, doesn't fit a traditional author or inventor story. Felix emerges from the New York studios of an Australian illustrator and entrepreneur, a guy called Pat Sullivan, and the work of his lead animator, a guy called Otto Mesmer. The Pat Sullivan studio comprised Sullivan, his wife, and Mesmer, three people. Okay. Both Sullivan and Mesmer drew a cat called Tom, who appeared in an animated cartoon for Paramount magazine, film magazine. The character's name was only changed to Felix in the third reel. But Tom or Felix wasn't really the first syndicated cartoon cat. The Hearst International Film Studio had produced Crazy Cat from 1915 to 1918, also a newspaper comic strip character. And in terms of animated film characters, there was a character called Mutton Jeff, which was a newspaper strip that was made into short films from 1911 on. So this had been going on sporadically, but had been happening for a while. But Felix was really, really popular. And in 1920, Sullivan agreed to produce one cartoon a month for Famous Players Lasky Corporation, or what we would understand as Paramount. But when Paramount magazine is shut down a couple of years later because the short film magazines were considered too expensive to produce, Sullivan realised he'd made a mistake. He'd assigned the copyright to the film studio. Disney had done the same thing with his first creation, a character called Oswald the Lucky Rabbit. Basically, Sullivan, through intimidation and bad behaviour, gets his own copyright and Felix back. He wasn't a nice guy. But what the world knows as Felix takes off really with the assistance of this woman who's credited at the bottom, her gender masked by the name MJ Winkler. Margaret Winkler was Harry Warner's secretary, and after Felix is cancelled by Paramount, Sullivan's going around all the film studios trying to actually get the same deal. Warner wasn't interested in a Felix the Cat clip, but Margaret Warner, the secretary, was. And with Harry Warner's support, she got her brother to set up a shingle around the corner in New York, and she started character merchandising. It was an international market from the start, which is interesting. It wasn't perceived as this stage production and domestic and then you go global. It was always perceived of as an international trade. Sullivan's first contract gave him $1,000 US for the first six film, $1,200 for the second six, and 50% on foreign sales. Okay, so it was always anticipated as a foreign trade, and with 50% on foreign sales, with a strong incentive for foreign trade. Pathé, the largest European-based film distributor, believed because of their distribution deal, they were entitled to make character merchandise as part of this arrangement. Sullivan didn't think so. The other thing that Pathé used to do is they used to cut up the reels, serialise it, in other words. So the story is broken up. He also was not impressed by that, but didn't do anything about it. The Felix clips that I'm about to show you were made by British Pathé in the UK. They're not obviously Felix clips, but these are news reels that always accompany the screenings. So for those of you who think flash mobs were a social media thing of the 21st century, it appears that they were actually also there at the very beginning of film history. Distributors are organising promotional events to create buzz and interest in their products. Here they're paying art students to help stage a news event, so then film and play as a short before their features in the studios. Pathé is also selling Felix merchandise to exhibitors so it could be for sale at the box office, cross promotion. But also was Pathé clearly organised the filming and editing here, you can see that this is not tightly orchestrated. I'm just moving on. So one of the things we need to think about here with something like Felix is what's the point of origin? What kind of thing, what kind of event, what kind of property, what kind of phenomenon is Felix? He doesn't come to us as an animation or an illustration that is then in a staged release in all these other mediums and other these platforms. He's an abstract property, a commercial opportunity from the very, very beginning. In Felix fandom, there's lots of complaints about the fact that Sullivan took credit over Otto Mesmer for the drawing of Felix, but it seems to me that there's much more complicated questions around the creation of this particular character for merchandise and enterprise. This one, Felix Goes to India, is interesting because it's a cross-promotion between Pathé Film, Pathé Magazines and a newspaper, again creating entertainment spectacle supported by the film character of Felix. It sort of points to me, what I consider to be 20th century character merchandising, which is dealing with synergies between mass communications media, international trade opportunities. These things are all conceived of as part of the commercial opportunity at the start. So starting to think about IP in terms of jurisdiction, domestic law, and these staged idea of protection of rights just doesn't really work with what type of phenomenon we're actually dealing with. Okay. So Margaret Winkler and Pat Sullivan fall out, but then Walt Disney comes in the door. This is the first thing that he got her, she got him to produce. It's an Alice in Wonderland animation featuring a live actor as Alice with animated characters. I want you to draw attention to the little cat character there, Julius the cat, which Pat Sullivan considered was a rip-off of Felix the cat. But of course, what becomes famous is Steamboat Willie and Mickey Mouse. Again, look at the credit. The animation studio is Walt Disney, but the artist is UBI Works, who was also involved in most of Walt Disney's other fictional creations. Okay. So Steamboat Willie is released in 1928. He enters into an exclusive film distribution agreement with a British company called Ardeal Films that's handling the renting of American films in the British Isles. There's also a contract with a children's book publisher, Deans and Sons, who make a Mickey Mouse annual in 1930, but it's not what we would understand as a Mickey Mouse comic. Somebody else actually does the drawings, and they're kind of like gag-a-page comics of, you know, funny drawings that Mickey happens to be one of the characters in. So this is the Deans rag book design registration of Mickey Mouse in 1929. One of the questions to ask here is lawyers is, did they need any authorization from Disney to actually register a doll? Disney had registered his own trademark for Mickey Mouse for films in 1928 and a patent for dolls in 1929, but only in the US. He hadn't any international infrastructure in place. He really hadn't given much thought to that at the time. It's quite similar to actually Warren's situation 20 years earlier, that, you know, they're aware that there's commercial opportunities, but they just don't have the infrastructure in place or the capacity to do it. There's no British case law that allowed copyright design or trademark protection to be extended to characters per se. Design law, not copyright, was also the law that applies to manufactured articles like dolls. The Patents Design and Trademark Act of 1883 allowed for applications to be made by the, quote, proprietor of any new or original design. Registration required the applicant to actually nominate the particular class of manufacturer for which they were seeking the monopoly. The protection was originally for 5 years, and then under the 1907 Act, it was extended by renewals to 15. So in December 1929, Dean's rag book gets the registration for Mickey. But by a month later, Disney have a place an agent in the UK, and Deans then sign a contractual agreement with Disney over characters other than Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse. So there seems to be some recognition that they've lost the boat in relation to Mickey. So the question is, what was the status of those original registrations? There was litigation when a German importer of a doll called Squeaky, a Mickey Mouse lookalike doll, you'll see Squeaky in a minute, Pomerantz, argued that when Dean sought to enforce their design right, that Pomerantz argued that they were not entitled to any registration because Mickey Mouse was not an original design. Everyone had seen the movies and therefore Dean's had not done anything original. This brought this response from the judge. The judge reflects on this and the competing claims and says that, you know, American is every day becoming more and more a necessary language for the legal profession to know. This is also a sign to arguments about the dominance of American film in England in the 1920s, where this is the era where Britain brings in local content quotas for film as an attempt to try and limit what was conceived to be an all-pervasive American influence that was actually corrupting British society. Justice Luxmore noted that there was an unreported case involving Felix, but was found not to be a copyright infringement to make a 3D reproduction of a 2D design. Why is that? Deans argued it took them a lot of ingenuity to make a 3D doll, and they also pointed out that their doll had original neckwear, teeth and whiskers, and they said that Mickey in the film didn't have neckwear, teeth or whiskers. And as you can see, this picture that British Toy Manufacturers Association gave expert evidence and said it takes an awful lot of study expertise to come up with these designs. The defendant, Pomerantz, gave evidence that he'd seen the Mickey films. That was the source of his picture for their squeaky design. But he said he hadn't seen the doll's design, Dean's doll design before the litigation was afoot, so he hadn't copied Dean's design at all. The judge found the Dean's registration was valid, but they declined to give them an injunction to protect their rights, saying there was no actual evidence of copying of the design from Dean's. And they said, and this is a competition concern that is normal within design law, that by registering one design for a mouse, Dean's should not be able to get a monopoly on all mouse toys or all toys with bows or all mouses with whiskers. And they said that anybody should be free to actually apply their Mickey design. In other words, when it comes to character merchandising, which is clearly rapidly apace in this society, the laws offer a reading which sees the industrial origins of these designs as precluding strong monopoly rights and seems to reject the author-centric narrative altogether. But why then does Dean seem to suggest in this advertisement in the trade press that they won the case and in fact that this was actually a good result? And you can see from that they talk about the fact there that that they hold the exclusive rights to the Mickey Mouse doll and they're going to sue any manufacturer who makes goods that look similar. They also argue that these rights are then essential to the toy trade and which is arguably a complete misrepresentation of the real legal situation. That squeaky Pomerantz and Sons advertised in the same magazine that they won. They won because Mickey didn't infringe any of Dean's registration, so competition is the big winner. Okay, so in summary, what's the conclusion to make of all this? Looking a little forward, what you then find is trademarks, copyright come to be used by Disney and other founders of character merchandise, but actually with quite mixed results in different jurisdictions, UK, Australia, Spain. There's some success, but it's always quite muted. It's quite clear that you have a significant industrial development, a significant cultural development, but law's not really a player in terms of supporting the trade. But what is really successful and comes out of this period is putting up these business infrastructures for the commercialisation and the licence of these rights regardless. 1930, Disney in Europe sets up Disney Enterprises and they put in place licensed agents. And the work of those licensed agents is to either buy the rights from pirates or to set up in competition with them or use other cultural strategies like Mickey Mouse clubs and things like that where they're continually teaching the importance of having the authentic product, the authorised goods. So what I would argue is that rather in these modern creations, the film creations of character merchandising, the real powerhouses of the 20th century in character merchandising, these are not author-centric creators. These are very different from the model of production and the system of rights that existed with Lewis Carroll's Alice or with Beatrix Potter. But these character creations still come to be understood in terms of that similar model. So we end up with this legal imaginary that comes to fill the void, which hides the corporate ownership and the corporate development of the practices and the role of law. We would also argue, Jose and I, that character merchandising are not tie-ins or sideshows. They're the main game of these enterprises. And we would actually say that intellectual property is constituted by the business relations that actually are affected in that space. Fragmentation of time, seeing markets in terms of not jurisdictions, but in terms of the way various kind of trade lines and opportunities develop as different types of synergistic practices. One of the conditions on manufacturing is often that your product has to be ready for release as part of the whole package. All those types of staged release and marketing is all tied in together. And we argue those business and commercial practices underpinned by contracts and license that constitute intellectual property, not the actual law itself and the protection of rights. And that's it.